Welcome, beloved listeners, gladdies and noddies and poddies and tweethuts to a radioactive edition of Late Night Live. I've been looking forward to tonight's program, not simply for a few days, but for decades, because it's going to focus on the life and times, the rise and fall of J. Robert Oppenheimer, whose one of many gifts was to speak Sanskrit, from which he borrowed when beholding the first atomic explosion. And he was heard to utter, "Brighter than a thousand suns." You could argue that he was brighter than a thousand suns himself, an immensely intelligent person. But I've had mixed feelings about him all my life, which is hardly surprising, given that, yes, I'm a 1939er. I was born in the year of the Second World War. I remember its end. Just as a kid, I remember hearing about Hiroshima. My first nickname at school, I'd forgotten this, was Atom Bomb. Kids called me Atom Bomb. And I well remember when the Bikini Atoll was obliterated by a nuclear test, giving its name, being remembered, lingering on in the very brief bathing suit so popular on shores which were being, at the time, slightly irradiated with strontium-90. A lot of this dates back to Oppenheimer, whose genius was absolutely crucial to the success of the Manhattan Project. And there's no question that Oppenheimer is one of the most fascinating and contentious figures of the last centuries. He was fluent in many languages other than Sanskrit, but he was nonetheless driven by his desire to overcome his status as an outsider, his Jewish and German heritage, to be at the very heart of American political and social life, and he certainly achieved that, at least for some considerable time. As leader of the Allied team to beat the Nazis in the race to develop the first atomic bomb, although we were later to discover that the Nazis weren't going too well on the project, and nor were the Japanese. Yes, the Japanese were also working on a plan to build a bomb, but it got absolutely nowhere. But his success, in a sense, or his triumph, was short-lived when the full implications of his creation and its future exploitation became clear. Oppenheimer's passionate arguments against the established view that the US should continue to produce bigger and better nuclear weapons brought him into great enmity with the monstrous Teller, creator of the H-bomb, and, of course, up against the Washington establishment. And bingo, he's caught up in security hearings in 1954. Now, Ray Monk, he's a professor of philosophy from Southampton University, has completed a massive biography which goes further than anything I've read in its understanding of this remarkable man. Ray has previously tackled Wittgenstein and Bertrand Russell, so he's got damn good credentials for the task. The book, Inside the Center, The Life of J. Robert Oppenheimer, and I'm delighted to welcome Ray to our little wireless program. He's talking to us from the BBC studios in Southampton. Ray, welcome. As a young man, he once said to a friend, "The kind of person I admire most would be one who becomes extraordinarily good at doing a lot of things, but maintains a tear-stained countenance."
Yes, yes. And in many ways that is a self-description, I think. I mean, one of the things that attracted me to Oppenheimer was the multifaceted nature of his intellectual interests and of his personal life. He had many, many interests, and as you indicated in your introduction, they weren't of a dilettante nature. I mean, his interest in Hinduism led him to master Sanskrit. He mastered languages very easily. He was an expert on French literature. He knew philosophy better than most philosophy professors. He was an extraordinarily intelligent man.
He's had this insatiable desire to be at the center.
Yeah.
This is something that outsiders often have, of course, and this is at the root of the ambivalence towards his Jewish ancestry, and at the root of what Einstein described, and this is a lovely line of Einstein's, his unrequited love for the US government. I think Einstein said something like, he was in love with a woman who didn't love him, the United States of America.
Yeah, that line is so good. I think I quote it twice in the book. It's so apt and so true. And I think, you know, Einstein put his finger on the whole tragedy of Oppenheimer's life in that remark.
It wasn't a love affair that Einstein himself had, was it?
No, Einstein didn't love the United States. The United States loved him and venerated him and treated him as a saint. And I think Oppenheimer knew Einstein well, of course, because when Oppenheimer was director of the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton, Einstein held a chair there. So they saw a lot of each other, and they knew each other well. And I think in Oppenheimer's criticisms of Einstein, there is, I think one can detect a note of jealousy that he wanted to be that man. And for a short while, very short while in the 40s, he was. It was Oppenheimer who was on the cover of Time magazine and Life magazine and so on. And that's where he wanted to be.
But there's no evidence, is there, or none that I can recall, of Einstein being jealous of him.
No, on the contrary. I don't think jealousy of other people was something that Einstein suffered very much.
No. His friend, Rabi, Isidore Rabi, said he was a man who was put together of many bright, shining splinters, but who lived a charade.
Yeah. Rabi said about Oppenheimer that he was always acting, he was always putting on a show. And I think this is to do with something that you mentioned earlier. Oppenheimer wasn't entirely comfortable in his own skin, as we say these days. You know, he was always wanting to be something that he wasn't. And Rabi, I think, you know, was closest to him and understood him better than anybody else. Partly because, I think, of the similarities and differences in their respective backgrounds. They both came from New York City. But Rabi was brought up, in the Lower East Side, to some a family of Eastern European Jews who had experienced poverty. Oppenheimer grew up in fabulous wealth in the Upper West Side of Manhattan to a German Jewish family, and I spent some part of the first chapter discussing that background.
Right, I thought I knew a lot about Oppenheimer, but on every page there were things that amazed me. I didn't realize he was raised under the spiritual mantle of the Ethical Culture Society, which was formed by German Jews who wanted to lose their Jewishness without, in fact, succumbing to Christianity or abandoning, of course, the ethical principles central to Judaism.
Yeah, that's right. It was a religion of deed, not of creed, as its founder Felix Adler said. And Oppenheimer's father was one of the leaders of the ethical culture movement. And as you say, it was a movement, and it was almost exclusively a movement of Upper West Siders. It was German Jews who wanted to do justice to the ethical parts of Judaism while stripping themselves of the ethnicity of being a German Jew and of any kind of supernatural beliefs.
We did a program a couple of days ago on Auguste Comte, who, as you know, set up his own sort of secular religion in the aftermath of the French Revolution, you know, trying to maintain a great respect for science, but dealing with what he thought a missing ingredient, that, you know, he seemed to think that people did need a transcendental belief of some sort as social glue. I don't think this society, the Ethical Culture Society, went that far, did they?
No, it was more to do with one's duty to one's fellow men. It was more to do with looking after the poor, working for the betterment of mankind. It was in some ways a rather austerely sort of ethical movement, and Oppenheimer, they had their own school, and Oppenheimer went to the school, and the emphasis on the school was firstly on intellectual attainment. The academic standards were very high, but secondly on being a good citizen.
I'm talking to Ray Monk about his book on Oppenheimer. It's interesting, you've written about Wittgenstein, Russell, and now Oppenheimer. All three of them, in fact, came from quite distinguished and affluent backgrounds.
They did, yes. I mean, there are strong similarities, I think, between Wittgenstein's background and Oppenheimer's. Both of them fabulously wealthy. Both of them as individuals more or less indifferent to wealth, actually.
But the sort of indifference you can only have if you've always had the wealth.
Well, that's true. And both of them from families that were both Jewish and not Jewish at the same time. And in a way that's in a way that's sort of elusive and difficult to describe and difficult to get hold of, and yet, as Rabi said about Oppenheimer, crucially important.
It was a time when great Jewish dynasties around New York, the Sachs, the Goldman, the Guggenheims, were not made part of the published social register. So the fact that his dad, you know, was a very successful member of the Jewish business elite, did not guarantee him entree to the upper echelons.
No, that's right. There was a sharp division in that respect between the Upper West Side and the Upper East Side, which is where, you know, the Carnegies and the Roosevelts and people like that had their huge brownstone mansions. And the Upper East Side was the elite society. The Upper West Side, where the wealthy German Jews lived, they formed a sort of self-consciously cohesive society that they called our crowd, which in some ways was set up in rivalry to the even wealthier elite on the Upper East Side.
Now, his parents shared an interest in art with a capital A. His mother was an accomplished artist with private students, a rooftop studio. And despite the preachings of the Ethical Society, which argued that the wealthy shouldn't enjoy the products of wealth, they were early buyers of Van Gogh and Picasso.
That's right. Their collection of paintings was worth a fortune. They had a Rembrandt, they had a Renoir, they had three Van Goghs, a Blue Period Picasso. When Oppenheimer's brother Frank ran into financial difficulties because he was stripped of his job, he only had to sell one of these paintings to keep himself in wealth for the rest of his life.
Yeah, I'm reminded of a wonderful biography by the filmmaker Renoir about his father, the painter, and he was asking his father why it was that most of the Impressionist paintings were in America, and he attributed simply to the fact that Americans were so bloody rich. And Renoir, the painter, said, no. He said, they were the first to understand us.
Oh, that's interesting.
They were young people. They were curious. They deserved to have the paintings. Perhaps the Ethical Cultural Society could have seen it through that prism.
Yes, maybe. And also, you know, with it being a young society, it's not hidebound, so it's open to new movements in art, you know, in a way that was greater, perhaps, than, you know, the corresponding elite in the old Western European countries.
I mentioned that when the bomb went off, the first of the three bombs, and his response was to quote that wonderful Sanskrit verse from one of the great Hindu texts.
So he later said. I mean, the eyewitness accounts don't remember him saying that.
Oh, dear. So that might be a bit of a myth. Perhaps he thought it.
Okay, what everybody knows about Oppenheimer is that when he saw the Trinity test, he quoted from the Bhagavad Gita and he says, "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." That comes from a recording that he made in the 60s, recreating that moment in 1945, in which he says, and he chose his words quite carefully, he said, that line came to me. He doesn't say he said it. What people remember him doing, actually, is clasping his hands above his head and looking triumphant. I think it's Oppenheimer, to some extent, rewriting history and giving him a more contemplative, reflective kind of reaction to the bomb. Whereas, in fact, what he and most of his colleagues felt when they saw the Trinity bomb go off was enormous jubilation and relief that all this hard work and money had paid off.
Were they still able to persuade themselves that what they were doing was legitimate? And I'm talking about this window between the first successful test and the dropping of the other two bombs on Japan. Were they still able to persuade themselves that what they were doing was morally justified because of the problems, the possibility, perhaps the probability of a Nazi bomb?
There was a lot of discussion of that. The thing is, they had all come to work at Los Alamos, persuaded by this argument that Oppenheimer himself pushed very vigorously. He said, we must get the bomb before the Nazis do, and the Nazis have got Heisenberg, one of the greatest, you know, quantum scientists in the world. There's a realistic chance that the Nazis will get the bomb, and we have to get it first. By the time the Trinity test happened in the summer of 45, it was already clear that the Nazi bomb, and it had been clear for a long time, it had been clear for, you know, about a year, that the Nazi bomb project was going nowhere, and there was no chance of a Nazi bomb.
And of course, that raises the issue, which is still much discussed, of whether Heisenberg simply failed, or whether he was, in a sense, a subversive within the Nazi structure.
Yes, and I think there is quite a record on this. I mean, Heisenberg's papers have survived from the war, and they don't bear out what he himself told Jung, who was the author of Brighter Than a Thousand Suns. Heisenberg gave the impression that he subverted the Nazi bomb project. There really isn't much evidence for that. And actually, there's some evidence that he presented papers to Nazi officials saying, you know, we could produce a bomb. The thing is that the Nazis, curiously, we think of German society, particularly that society, as relentlessly efficient and mechanized. But actually, the problem was that refining uranium requires, as Niels Bohr said, turning a whole country into a factory. And yeah, the Americans were prepared to do that. One of the aspects of the Manhattan Project that's often not emphasized as much as it should is the sheer scale of the industrial operation.
Yeah,
two whole towns were created for doing nothing but producing fissile material in Hanford in Washington and Oak Ridge in Tennessee. And the Germans didn't have that. And that, I think, was the main reason why their project got nowhere.
Well, there's another reason. That is, they'd got rid of all their Jewish scientists.
Well, yes, yes. There's a lovely remark by Churchill, Winston Churchill, who said, the reason we won the war is that our Germans were better than their Germans.
Yeah, okay. Oppenheimer, quote, I repaid my parents' confidence in me by developing an unpleasant ego, which I'm sure must have affronted both adults and children who were unfortunate enough to come into contact with me. That's okay, that's what he says later, but many people also describe a remarkably charismatic and charming human.
Not in childhood, though. In childhood, he is remembered as being difficult to get on with and precocious in a way that's almost certain to alienate people. One of his classmates remembers him saying, ask me a question in Latin and I'll reply in Greek. You know, it's very intellectually impressive, but it's not the way to win friends at school.
And when he was studying the Hindu text, he skited to his brother that they were an easy read.
Yes, that's right. And when he was lecturing in California, he asked one of his graduate students to do his lectures, and his student said, what text are you using? And he gave him this textbook that was in Dutch. And the student complained about this, and Oppenheimer said, but it's such easy Dutch.
Okay, on his 16th birthday, his very wealthy father gives him a 26-foot sloop, which he races on the bay shore near their luxurious weekender, which leads us into your revelation that he was a hard-drinking, chain-smoking Marlborough man capable of reckless acts of physical bravery.
Yeah, that's right. He used to worry his parents with his reckless sailing. I mean, he would court danger, both sailing and horse riding, actually. I mean, when he first went to New Mexico, he learned to ride horses and very quickly became very adept, and then pushed himself and his horses, to an alarming extent and, several times actually put himself in danger.
He's 18, and when he finds a couple of friends with whom he could connect on an intellectual level, Frank Ferguson, Paul Horgan, tell us about that.
They were from the Southwest. Oppenheimer, as we've been discussing, came from this very, specific society, the Upper West Side German Jews of Manhattan. And he never felt that he belonged there. And it's very telling that the one friend he had at school, at the Ethical Culture School, was Francis Ferguson, who wasn't a Jew and who wasn't a New Yorker. He came from New Mexico, which is about as far as you can get from New York, both geographically and, as it were, spiritually. And Ferguson came from a very distinguished family in the Southwest. And he invited Oppenheimer over to New Mexico. That's where Oppenheimer met Horgan. And the three of them formed this sort of troika, as they called it. They were all very keen on literature. They loved the Southwest. and they spent their time riding around the lovely New Mexican countryside.
And while he's into this bareback horse riding, he meets a young woman who becomes his first love, age 19.
That's right, with exotic ancestry, you know, involving Mexicans and Spaniards and Native American Indians, and that was, I'm sure, part of the allure for Oppenheimer. She was rather grand in a way that, you know, only the Old West could produce, not grand in the New York way. And he was in love with her, yes.
Ferguson and Horgan, both writers, and Oppie's determined to be seen as a literary man in their eyes. What does he do to win them over?
Well, he writes short stories, and during his time at Harvard, he became more and more interested in physics. But before that, when he was still in a formative sort of stage, he spent as much time on creative writing, on writing short stories mainly, as he spent on science. And he would show these short stories for Francis Ferguson mainly, whose approval he wanted. And Ferguson was rather critical of them, and eventually Oppenheimer abandoned his ambitions to be a writer. But those ambitions played a large part in his life. He took them very seriously, and he took himself very seriously as a short story writer.
Okay.
None of them have survived, which is indicative, of what he later came to think of them.
Oppenheimer found at Cambridge that he couldn't match his peers intellectually. Now, that will come as a surprise to the listener.
Well, he felt that he wasn't up to the task. Okay, so he was at Harvard. He was, you know, noted as a, you know, exceptionally gifted physicist. The problem with Cambridge, so he went to Cambridge. He wanted to work with Ernest Rutherford at the Cavendish, but he couldn't. But the problem was that he went to Cambridge to work on experimental physics, and he was hopeless in the lab. And he felt belittled by that. He felt that he was constantly failing to come up to the expectations that the person who's put in charge of him was Patrick Blackett, who was a very distinguished experimental physicist.
Well, tell us about the poisoned apple he left for Patrick Blackett.
That's right. Oppenheimer, feeling for the first time in his life that he wasn't up to the task, went mad, essentially. The first 6 months that he was in Cambridge, you can see he had a breakdown, and this took several forms, one of which was he left a poisoned apple on Patrick Blackett's desk, apparently with the intention of killing him. Poisoned with cyanide, and he was summoned by the Cambridge University authorities, who surprisingly didn't send him down. They allowed him to stay at Cambridge on the condition that he got psychiatric help. And I'm not convinced that the psychiatric help did much. I think the extraordinary development in that year from, you know, Oppenheimer clearly undergoing acute emotional trauma to him, you know, publishing leading work in quantum physics. The root of that, I think, is the transition from experimental physics to theoretical physics, a field in which he could excel.
I'm talking to Ray Monk, author of a new biography of Oppenheimer, father of the A-bomb. I could have raised earlier the issues of his sexual problems because his friends commented on them. And so he sent off to a therapist by the university's behest. Naturally thinks the doctor's too stupid to help him. And yeah. I like this. After locking his mother in her hotel room while on holiday in Paris, she insisted he see a Parisian psychiatrist who diagnosed sexual frustration, and the prescription was sex with a prostitute.
That's right. And who knows whether that made him any better or not. You can see him beginning to flourish, not because he has sex with prostitutes in Paris, but because he becomes gripped by the emerging field of quantum mechanics.
Yes, Bertrand Russell seemed to have a more ebullient sex life. I can't remember about Wittgenstein.
Wittgenstein had almost no sex life. Wittgenstein was gay, of course, had gay sex maybe two or three times in his life. But for the most part, led a austerely celibate existence.
Fred Ferguson, who told people that His friend had a few sexual problems. He is visited by Oppenheimer in Paris, and Oppenheimer tries to strangle him.
That's right. Within a month or so of trying to kill Patrick Blackett, he tries to kill Francis Ferguson, who was his best friend.
I'm glad he's not around. He might want to kill his biographer.
Well, as I say, you know, within a very short time of that, so that was in the new year of 1926, a couple of months later, he's in fine, you know, physical and mental health. But he did try to kill Ferguson. He stood no chance because Ferguson was a taller, stronger man than Oppenheimer, Oppenheimer came up behind him, I think, with a strap from a suitcase, didn't he, and tried to strangle him with this strap, and Ferguson was able to shake him off. Remarkably, remained his close friend.
Now, Oppie wasn't a great admirer of Tolstoy's, loved Dostoevsky, and you reveal that one of his life-changing experiences came from Proust, from a passage you read. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a passage in which Proust describes a lesbian affair and describes a girl spitting on a picture of her father. And what attracted Oppenheimer to this piece of writing was Proust reflecting that this girl wouldn't have felt herself to be so evil if she'd been able to see the evil in others. And that was what Oppenheimer, much later in life, told people was a revelation to him, that he could, you know, he doesn't have to see himself as uniquely evil. He can recognize the evil in himself and also see the evil in other people, and that that Oppenheimer described as a turning point in you know, an epiphany in his life.
Now the work he does. Sorry, I interrupted.
No, well, I was going to say that in that particular case, what documentary evidence there is does bear out Oppenheimer's later reflections, because that was in the spring of 1926, and almost immediately when Oppenheimer returned to Cambridge, you can see that he was in much better mental and physical shape.
He's transformed from a failing experimental physicist to an up-and-coming theorist, and the doors open for him to work with Max Born, studying quantum mechanics.
Yeah, that's right. Max Born visits Cambridge and is very impressed with Oppenheimer, who by this stage has given up any attempt to work as an experimental physicist, has become friends with Paul Dirac, who's one of the leading theoretical physicists of the 20th century, and Dirac introduces him into this, you know, amazing development of quantum mechanics, and Oppenheimer becomes totally obsessed with this. At the same time, Max Born visits Cambridge, is very impressed with Oppenheimer. Born is based at Göttingen and invites Oppenheimer to Göttingen, and that's when Oppenheimer completes his PhD within a few months.
And Steven Weinberg, Nobel laureate, describes the work there as, quote, the most profound revolution in physical theory since the birth of modern physics in the 17th century. Wow.
Yeah, well, it's most extraordinary. And the people involved in that movement in 26 and subsequent years knew that they were in on something terribly exciting. Everybody knew that, you know, the very foundations of physics were being changed here, and that problems that had defeated some of the greatest minds in the last 20 years were now being solved.
Newtonian mechanics are effectively off to the scrap heap, as quantum mechanics with all its counterintuitive truths comes in.
That's right, and it provided explanations for aspects of the old quantum physics, the quantum physics of Niels Bohr, left, you know, unanswered questions about the behavior of electrons, and the new quantum mechanics gave, you know, satisfactory theoretical explanations for that. But in the process, as you say, provided a completely new foundation for physics itself.
Now, Einstein wasn't too happy with this. He couldn't believe that aspects of quantum mechanics were correct. And, of course, he makes that famous remark in a letter to Born that God does not play dice.
Yeah, that's right. Because it's an aspect of quantum mechanics that you have to relinquish the deterministic framework of classical Newtonian physics. You now have a statistical framework where you can say what will probably happen, you cannot say that it certainly will happen, and therefore you have to abandon determinism in favour of a certain degree of uncertainty, Heisenbergian uncertainty.
Yeah.
And the remarkable thing is that the mathematics of that was worked out by three different people, Paul Dirac, Heisenberg, and Born, all at the same time, and the mathematics is weird and wonderful.
Now, a surprise in the book is what you reveal about Born's sort of acquiescence to Oppenheimer.
Yes.
His
yes.
Born, the leader of the team in Germany, he allows himself to be intimidated by Oppie,
yeah.
who would rudely override or correct his lectures. No yeah. wonder he was glad when Oppenheimer finally
no.
left.
It's amazing, because Born was then recognized as one of the leading physicists in the world. He himself had learnt mathematics with David Hilbert, who was one of the greatest mathematicians ever. Oppenheimer's weakness, actually, as a physicist, was his mathematics. And yet Born allows himself to be intimidated by this young man who, you know, hadn't published anything of note when he arrived in Göttingen. So it's testimony to Oppenheimer's extraordinary confidence and his charisma. It's as if the old schoolboy who was challenging people to ask him questions in Latin and he could reply in Greek, it's as if that schoolboy has now, you know, he's suffered a blow to his ego and to his well-being in Cambridge, and now he's back with that arrogance and that confidence and that ability to intimidate everybody around him.
But he's also tormented. He's striving to understand subatomic particles. It eludes him for decades, something which bothered him and tore him apart, his terms.
Yeah.
And you say that unless we understand or have some appreciation of his contribution to science, we can never understand the human being.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why this book took me 11 years. You know, I'm not a physicist. I'm a philosopher. But it seems to me in general that if you're dealing with somebody who spends most of their energy trying to solve intellectual problems or trying to write, then you cannot understand that person. You can't understand Wittgenstein if you don't understand his philosophy. And it seems to me you can't understand Oppenheimer unless you have some grasp, at least, of what problems he spent, you know, a large part of his life thinking about. Which is why I devote so much space to his work in the 30s on quantum electrodynamics and on meson theory and cosmic ray theory and all the various things that he was interested in.
Oppenheimer's greatest contribution to physics is often said to be the work in the 1930s on neutron stars and what would become black holes. Was he unfairly overlooked by not getting a Nobel?
Well, you see, you can only get a Nobel if you're still alive. And my view is that if he'd lived for another year or two, he might well have been given the Nobel Prize, because it was in the months, the years after he died, that experimental evidence was produced for the existence of neutron stars. And at that point, I think the Nobel Committee might have recognized him for having, just on mathematical grounds, you know, he just said, let's see what happens to the mathematics if you assume continual gravitational collapse. And you know, he worked out the mathematics and the physics in collaboration, it has to be said, with his students. But he worked out the mathematics and physics of gravitational collapse into neutron stars. And then, most boldly of all, his paper with Schneider in 1939, where he's predicting the existence of black holes.
Now,
when they had experimental evidence that neutron stars existed, then there were some grounds for thinking that whole way of treating the mathematics of relativity theory must be right. And at that stage, I think he might well have been given a Nobel Prize.
So here's a person of intense intellectual ambition, combined with fervent patriotism, and he's driven to make America the world center of advances in physics, and he damn well does.
Yeah, it's amazing. He and Rabi and all the American physicists who learnt their quantum theory on the continent, and particularly in Germany, and in Oppenheimer's case in Zurich in Switzerland as well, they were so fed up at the condescension that they received from, you know, European physicists who said, well, okay, you've got important experimental physicists in America, but you don't have any theorists. And they all returned to the States determined to make America the world center of theoretical physics. And with some considerable help from Hitler, of course, they succeeded in doing that.
So he's appointed to lead the Manhattan Project in 1942, which many regarded as bizarre. One of his colleagues joked that Oppie couldn't run a hamburger stand, still less a large complex organization, because he was temperamentally volatile, patronizing, inept in social relations, etc. But he didn't
inept in a laboratory,
as you pointed out, and yet he brought it off.
Yeah, amazing. There were some signs that he could do that. The summer school that he directed in Berkeley, where he got all the luminaries, as he put it, all the people who knew the most about nuclear fission together to talk about the practicalities of making a bomb. He's remembered as leading all those seminars, as understanding all the different parts of the problem. And so he's enormously impressive there. But his directorship of the Los Alamos Laboratory was a shock to everybody. And everybody who was there comments on how important Oppenheimer was to the success of the project.
Working with experimentalists and engineers.
And mothers and army personnel and whoever.
He liked generals, though, didn't he? And it's to some extent, generals liked him, at least for a while.
Well, it goes back to what you began by saying about his desire to be at the centre. He was delighted when he was appointed director of this laboratory, and he loved the company of high-ranking military personnel, high-ranking politicians, because it made him feel that he finally had made the center of American society.
Now, even at Los Alamos, there were allegations of communism that were haunting him, and he was advised he would have to betray old friends in the party in order to demonstrate loyalty to America. What did he do?
Okay, well, before he went to Los Alamos, shortly before he went to Los Alamos, his close friend, Harkin Chevalier, who was a member of the Communist Party, and Oppenheimer, by the way, we sort of glossed over this, but in the 1930s, Oppenheimer was actively involved in very left-wing politics. Most of his friends were communists, and he never became a member of the Communist Party formally.
But that's hardly unusual for, for intellectuals at the time.
And people forget this, but the Communist Party was held in suspicion by the FBI in the 30s, but it wasn't especially disapproved of by wider society. But in any case, his close friend Harkon Chevalier made a very clumsy attempt to persuade Oppenheimer to operate as a spy, essentially leaking secrets from the Los Alamos project to George Eltington, who was a British person working with Soviet espionage. Oppenheimer, in order to instill confidence, in order to gain the confidence of the security people at Los Alamos, went to see them and said, keep an eye on George Eltington, but try to keep Chevalier's name out of it. And it was extraordinarily naive, and not for the first time or the last time, Oppenheimer underestimated the people he was dealing with. They weren't going to let it go. He said, watch out for George Eltington. Of course, they knew all about George Eltington. What interested them was that Oppenheimer knew about George Eltington, and they wanted to know how did he know and who had told him and so on and so on. And they weren't going to rest until he gave them those names. And eventually, he was forced to give them the name of Harkon Chevalier. And Chevalier didn't know that until much later.
You say, in summary, the question of whether Oppenheimer was a communist is rather like the question of whether he was or was not a German Jew. He did not consider himself to be German, Jewish, or communist, and yet, as these words are commonly used, he was ethnically a German Jew and politically a communist.
Yeah.
So there's no doubt operationally of his inclinations.
That's right, and he gave money regularly to the party. He supported most of what they did. He was chastened in the late 30s by the reports from his Russian friends about life in the Soviet Union, and bit by bit his sympathies for communism and for the Soviet Union were weakened. The Soviet Nazi Pact was a big moment in that. But in the early and mid 30s, he supported what the Communist Party were doing because he saw them as the only party doing anything effective in the Spanish Civil War.
There are so many parts of the story that we cannot begin to discuss tonight, and the listener, of course, has to rush out and buy at least one copy of your book. But I should point out that Kitty, the missus, took off for months, leaving her newborn baby in the care of a babysitter, and Oppenheimer tries to hand over the daughter to the babysitter, who says, "No, why are you even asking me that?" And he says, "Because I am unable to love her." So his emotional inabilities or, you know, haunt him all his life.
Yes, that's right. Well, also, of course, the demands on him at that time were absolutely fantastic. I mean, imagine, you know, in the spring of 1943, being put in charge of the most important, most secret military project of the United States and being told, "I want you to produce 2 working atomic bombs in 18 months.
On different technical assumptions.
On different, you know, one using uranium, one using plutonium. Particularly with regard to plutonium, which of course doesn't exist in nature, and nobody had really seen it in 1943. Nevertheless, he's got to gather people together to work out the chemical properties of plutonium. He's got to get people to work out how you use uranium and plutonium in a bomb. And he's got, you know, General Groves and the entire US political military establishment breathing down his neck. It's not surprising he didn't feel up to the demands of fatherhood.
I should point out that years ago I made contact with some people who knew him or had been on the, at least on the edges of Manhattan Project. And their attitude was that the bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima were justified because nobody, not even Oppenheimer, could actually know that they were going to work. In other words, another demo might have been a fizzer.
That was the argument Oppenheimer used, and he thought it justified the Hiroshima bomb. I think he and most of the scientists at Los Alamos were shocked by the second bomb. They were shocked by Nagasaki because they thought that the first bomb was horrendous enough. And they thought that Japan would surrender and that there was no justification for unleashing another bomb so quickly after the Hiroshima bomb.
Ray, quite often on the program over the years, other scholars have argued that the bomb wasn't really aimed at Japan so much as at Stalin. And you think of the timing of the bomb with Yalta. But that's, you know, takes us off in all sorts of other directions.
It does. I think there is some evidence for that, in fact. I mean, they wanted a surrender, and they wanted a surrender quickly because they didn't want the Soviets in on that theatre of war.
So it wasn't so much the argument, which I always thought was specious, that it saved a million deaths on, you know, with armies in conflict.
Well, I wouldn't dismiss that argument so quickly. I mean, they did have an invasion force in place. They had calculated how many US soldiers would die in taking these islands, you know, because there was no sign that the Japanese were going to surrender. There was every sign that the Japanese were going to defend every last island to the death. And that would have resulted in horrendous casualties. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think the main reason for doubt is the second bomb. Even if you could persuade yourself of Oppenheimer's argument that the first bomb is justified because, well, first of all, to save all those, you know, thousands of American lives, and secondly, because a demonstration might be counterproductive because it might fizzle, neither of those things justify the second bomb because there was every sign that the Japanese were all ready to surrender, you know, after Hiroshima.
Well, let's think of it. Let's play a mind game. If you wiped out Las Vegas, it's hardly necessary to wipe out San Francisco a few
days
later.
Yeah. Exactly. I think the idea that it's directed at the Soviets is particularly applicable to the second bomb because what is the purpose of that second bomb? It's not to get the Japanese to surrender. The Japanese were already ready to surrender. The purpose of the second bomb is to convince the Soviets which was in fact false, to convince the Soviets that they had, you know, any number of these bombs and they could keep on using them. In fact, of course, after Nagasaki, they didn't have any more bombs, you know, for a while. But clearly the intention was to give the impression that they could keep dropping these bombs for as long as, you know, as long as it took.
We haven't got much time left, so let's race through some of this. I, as an old lefty, Indeed, as a teenage communist, I joined the rush to demonise Edward Teller, who'd worked on the A-bomb with Oppy and then was pushing very hard for the H-bomb. Now, yeah. Teller and was amongst the most powerful haters of Oppenheimer.
Yes.
And told the FBI that Oppenheimer was acting on orders from Moscow. Yes. Why such hatred? And I know it also involved David Griggs, but why such intensity of hatred?
It does take some understanding, doesn't it? I mean, after all, Oppenheimer had bent over backwards to placate Teller. Teller was never very interested in the fission bomb, the atomic bomb. From a very early stage, he thought that was, from a scientific point of view, trivial. It was just an engineering task to make a bomb using uranium and to make a bomb using plutonium based on fission. He was more interested in fusion, and he realized, as everybody realized, that if you could get a fusion reaction going, it would be a hell of a lot more lethal than a fission reaction. And he spent his time at Los Alamos working on what he then called the super bomb. And Oppenheimer gave him, you know, gave him facilities, gave him staff. But I think I think Teller felt slighted by Oppenheimer. One of the things was he felt slighted that Oppenheimer had chosen Hans Bethe to be in charge generally of theoretical science at Los Alamos. Teller thought that he himself should have been given that role. But given that he wasn't interested in fission, it's a bit perverse to think that he would then be, you know, put in charge of the theoretical aspect of the fission bomb. So, yes, he felt slighted. He felt jealous. He wanted, you know, he had this almost insane passion for producing a hydrogen bomb. And I think Teller was prepared to do anything to see that through. And again, ironically, the first fusion explosion, Teller had very little to do with it. He'd left Los Alamos. It was produced by scientists working at Los Alamos under Norris Bradbury. And Teller, meanwhile, was sulking in Princeton. So, you know, Teller had very little to do with it. And yet it was in his eyes and in fact, his baby.
So he's driven basically from public life. He's humiliated. He's degraded. The ultra patriot must have found this absolutely intolerable.
Oh yes.
And
yes.
Yet towards the end of his life, he turns against the Hindu philosophies of detachment, doesn't he? There's that speech to the Congress of Cultural Freedom, an organization that anyone on the left always despised because of its CIA connections. Yeah. He said, "It is because I am too much of a Jew, much too much of a Christian, far too much an American, for I believe in the meaningfulness of human history and of our role in it, and above all, of our responsibility to it." Yeah. So he's reaffirming a humanist creed, isn't he?
Yeah, it's quite a moving speech, that, I think, because he is, as you say, renouncing the detachment that, I mean, you know, why was Oppenheimer interested in Hinduism? I think the philosophy of detachment was an important aspect of that. And I think actually crucially important in enabling him to be the man responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. You know, how can you cope with the responsibility for doing that? Well, one way of coping would be to be detached. And towards the end of his life, when he makes a conscious effort to be attached to people, to be, you know, engaged with them, I think emotionally would have taken a large effort.
So you quote George Kennan at his at Oppenheimer's funeral. Quote, "A man who had a deep yearning for friendship, for companionship, for the warmth and richness of human communication, but neither circumstances nor at times the asperities of his own temperament permitted the gratification of this need, in a measure remotely approaching its intensity." That seems to nail the internal tragedy of the man.
It's a beautiful piece of writing, and it's absolutely right, I think, yeah. And as you say, it captures something centrally important. Oppenheimer craved affection. He craved companionship. He craved contact with people. And yet, on so many important occasions, was then able to achieve it.
In the 1960s, he gave many talks, and one of his favourite themes was the imperfection of mankind, something that you and I observe on a daily basis on school, right? And this is another quote I liked. "We have lost something in our secularised age that can be found in the great religions. It is the knowledge of the inwardness of evil and an awareness that in our dealings with this, we are very close to the centre of life. When we are blind to the evils in ourselves, we dehumanise ourselves and we deprive others, not only of our own destiny, but of any possibility of dealing with the evil in others. That's, once again, beautifully written, but it's almost as though he's psychoanalyzing himself.
I think that's right, and I think he felt the need to do that. And after all, it was something he'd been unable to do because of his scientific and political and military commitments. He'd been able to, as we say, work on himself. And I think towards the end of his life, he felt acutely that need to take stock of himself and to try and understand himself, and also to communicate himself. The last chapter of my book is called an open book? He spoke often of wanting to be. His ideal was to be an open book, and his tragedy was that he could never be that.
Okay, did you find him writing about death or thinking about personal mortality?
Not about death or mortality or his, I mean, there are a couple of mentions you can find in his conversations and in his letters, matter-of-factly accepting that he's going to die, but not reflecting on death, no. One of his last utterances was to a colleague of his at Princeton, Sam, and he said, one of his last utterances was, "Sam, don't smoke."
Was it hard to get access to the stuff in the US?
No, not at all. It's all there in the Library of Congress, and I made several visits to Washington, D.C. I think there's 264 boxes of Oppenheimer documents, and I went through every single box. And I also had great help. I went to the Bohr Institute Library in Copenhagen. The people running that were enormously helpful. The American Institute of Physics it did some remarkable interviews with all the leading scientists of the Los Alamos Project, most of whom had already died when I started my work. And those are all, the American Institute of Physics have made all of those available. So all the material was there. All I needed was the time to read it and reflect upon it and shape it into, some kind of coherent form.
Well, interest in this bike has never disappeared or vanished. He comes back into focus again and again. But you've done him proud. I mean, invested as much time and effort in Oppenheimer as you, with the possible exception of Oppenheimer.
I mean, he is somebody that I find endlessly fascinating. He's not somebody... partly because he's not somebody you feel that you ever quite get. And so you keep searching for, a key that's going to unlock his personality. You know, every now and again he does something, you think, why the hell did he do that? Why did he betray
Bernard Peters? I can't let you speculate because we're out of time. Ray, okay. Thank you very much. Ray Monk, Inside the Center, Life of J. Robert Oppenheimer, published by Jonathan Cape. I commend it to you. That's your lot. Thank you, team. Producers Christine Short, Muda Tardias, Anne Arnold, Exec Prod, Gail Basaria, and the technical wizards Paul Goff and Simon Branthwaite. Oh, don't forget to follow the program on Twitter at LNL on RN, or me, if you dare, at Philip Adams ABC. Stick around now for the news.